This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk, and today we have a special guest. He's a New York Times bestselling author. His new book is called The Widow Strike. It's a Pike Logan thriller, and he's here to talk about it. Brad Taylor, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you for having me.
I'm enjoying this book immensely. It's very interesting. Tell me about, for people who haven't read a Pike Logan book, tell them what it's all about.
Well, Pike Logan is he's kind of a compilation of a bunch of people I've served with when I was in the military. And he works for a unit called the Task Force, which is completely off the grid and beyond the normal intelligence community and defense establishment. And what's kind of funny about that is now everybody kind of believes that kind of stuff exists with Snowden running around. But I actually created it that way so that nobody would accuse me of writing about a real unit I'd served in. So I made a unit that I thought would be completely false, and people seem to think it's real. And he goes around, you know, solving the problems that other people can't solve.
It must seem real to them. That's why they think it's real. He really makes it sound authentic. You know, like there really is something. Do you think there is something like this in the world?
No. Well, there may be in foreign countries. There's, you know, the Russians have some things going on, and the Cuds Force itself, the main antagonist in the book, is a kind of a evil twin of the task force. It works for the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, and their sole mission is to go around the world creating havoc.
Right. Now, Cud, is that spelled Q-U-D?
It's phonetically spelled that way. Some people spell it Q-O-D-S, some spell it Q-U-D-S. It's an Arabic term for Jerusalem. They call it the Jerusalem Force.
Interesting. Now, you tell me your background.
I served for close to 22 years in the U.S. Army, most of that time in Special Forces, almost all that time in Special Forces, actually.
Right. Wow. And you were a lieutenant colonel?
Mm-hmm. I retired as lieutenant colonel.
Right. Now, what made you decide to go into writing? I mean, were you writing even when you were in?
No, I've always been a voracious reader. I've read always the guy that always had a book to read and always had one in the field with me. And I'd always wanted to write a book. It was just a goal of mine. And my last assignment, I left Fort Bragg from a command. I had a special mission unit. And I became an instructor, a professor of military science at the Citadel in Charleston. And it was like getting off a bullet train and starting to walk. I had a lot of time on my hands. So I said, I'll see if I could write a book. And I fully expected it just, end up on the nightstand as something I'd accomplished. But it, amazingly enough, it sold. And Pike Logan and the Task Force were born.
That's amazing. I mean, that so often happens that people say, oh, I'll just try this, and they tend to like it, and then they become successful at it. I mean, it's not everybody that becomes successful. So why do you think your books are read so much?
I don't know. I think I set out to, characters mean more to me than anything else. I mean, I can write about the weaponry and the bombs going off and that kind of stuff because it's something I know. But if I'd have been a police officer or a priest, Pike Logan would remain the same, but the settings would be completely different. I think I set out to write a moral component. Too often in the movies you see if these bureaucrats would get off my back and I could use this drill bit on this guy's knee, I'd solve the problem. When that's not the case, special forces operators have a moral framework and operate with a moral compass, and they make life or death decisions, and they live with those decisions, and sometimes they're wrong decisions. And I think that comes through in the character of my books.
Right. Now, when you get into special forces, I mean, what kind of training do you have beforehand? I mean, what do you do?
It's kind of a loaded question because the special operations forces have a varied field. Air Force has them, Navy has them, obviously with the SEALs are all over the news. For me, specifically, the Army Special Forces, known as the Green Berets, you can't join straight in. I had to go in as an infantry officer first, and I served a tour of duty in the infantry, then applied for and had to try out for Special Forces, and then through with the Q course, which is about a year-long course, qualification course is what they call it.
Right. So you go through an awful lot. It's not like you just go in. It's like a boot, almost like a boot camp kind of thing.
Oh, it's way beyond boot camp. I mean, boot camp's the first thing you do when you get in the Army. This is, I guess, would be advanced training.
Right. And obviously, you really enjoyed your time there. 22 years, that's a long time.
Yeah, I really did. I enjoyed every minute. In fact, retiring in and of itself was a hard decision. But when Rough Man sold, that was one of the reasons I did it.
So is writing as much fun for you?
Yeah, it definitely is. I miss the calling of the military. I miss the national purpose, but I certainly don't miss the stress. Writing is the best job in the world. You can do whatever you want to as long as you make your deadline.
Right. You can even sit in an air-conditioned room and do all your research.
Right.
I say that because it's like 100 degrees here. When you have to go, it feels like, you know, when you go out to work and you get in your car and you're in that heat, I mean, that feels more like work sometimes, too, when you're at home.
Well, I mean, I do a ton of research for all the novels that I write. For Enemy of Mine last January, I mean, I went to Qatar and Dubai and all over the Middle East. For The Widow's Strike, this book, I went to Hong Kong, Macau, Singapore, Bangkok.
So you actually go to all these places?
Yeah. There's a lot of settings that are in the book. The reason they're in the book is precisely because I experienced it on the ground. For instance, Elena, the Black Widow, she's feeling a little bit xenophobic. She gets off the Hong Kong airport, and she's walking through the airport, and they have a screening section. She doesn't know what it is, but they're checking her temperature to see if she's got the flu. Well, I wouldn't have known that just by using Google Earth. I knew that because when I got off the plane, I felt like she did. Everybody in there was Asian. Nobody spoke English. And why is that lady aiming a weapon-looking thing at me?
Right, exactly. It's amazing. I mean, research. I mean, you don't even think of it. When you read a book, you think, oh, and you just follow the story. You don't think of all the research that has to be done beforehand. I mean, Jeffrey Deaver says he does like 500 pages of research before he even writes a book.
Yeah, I'll tell you, 99% of my research doesn't even make it into the book. But it's kind of like an iceberg thing. If I don't have the stuff underneath the water, then I won't have the stuff at the top. So it doesn't make it in the book, but it is necessary. There's a lot of things that end up in the book that I have no intention of using, and it ends up being such a unique experience while I'm there. It ends up in the book. For instance, I knew that you could do biomedical research in Singapore, but I could not find out online where that was. I just researched and couldn't do it. Well, I got to Singapore, and the best I've found throughout my Special Forces time, the best person to ask anything of is a cabbie. They know everything. So I got a cab out of the airport, and I said, if I wanted to do biomedical research, where would I go? And he said, you go to Biosphere. Right off the top of his tongue, he said it. And sure enough, I end up at the Biosphere, and I'm doing research.
You need one of those cabbies in your house to help you with the research, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's amazing. Some people, that's true of anything in life. You have to know who to ask. I mean, you can find out anything you want, and a lot of it you can find out on the internet, but knowing who to ask is the right. It's like customer service. When you call these customer service departments, yeah, you have to know who to talk to. Some people know what they're talking about, and some people have no clue what they're talking about.
Right.
Which is why it's so dangerous to ask for directions anywhere, you know, because you never know if they're giving you the right directions.
Oh, yeah. We experienced that quite a bit, too, because nobody spoke English. There's one scene in the book, The Widow's Strike, where Elena thinks she's gotten on the wrong ferry because the ferry leaves 7 minutes early. And she's like, holy moly, I'm on the wrong ferry and nothing's in English. Well, that's because we were leaving Macau to get back to our flight on Hong Kong. And it was 6 in the morning. The ferry was supposed to leave at 10 after 6. And at 6:02, it took off. And we were convinced we were going to Shanghai and not to Hong Kong because we were on the wrong ferry.
Now, how much time did you spend in all these places?
It's a whirlwind. I mean, it definitely is work. I literally, no more than 2 days in each place, and you're running from the minute you hit the ground. So I have some general ideas of what I want to look at, some general themes that I need to know, but then the rest of it is I just go, and it comes to me as I move.
Now, do you take notes as far as what the places look like and how they're arranged?
Yeah, I take a camera with me, and I take a ton of pictures of, like, for I just finished a novel. I was down in Mexico City doing research, and I just take a ton of pictures to remind me of what specifically it looked like. So when I describe it in the book, you can see it, taste it, feel it, smell it. And the picture will bring that back for me, so I take a lot of pictures while I'm over there.
Right. It's funny, I can hear in your voice that you were in Special Forces or something like that. I mean, you have such a commanding voice. I mean, you have this kind of voice that you imagine like you would hear, and it's interesting. So I'm just impressed with all the research you do. I mean, I can't imagine Tom Clancy actually does research on his books, but, you know, other than, I mean, actually going to all the places he writes about.
Well, a lot of it's like Tom Clancy research, too, because I'm not a doctor, and the widow strike deals with a pandemic, and so I had to read 5 or 6 books on pandemics and flu and transmission and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's a fascinating part, and the doctor and his son and everything, that's a fascinating part of the book. Now, these characters, Pike and his friends, actually have nicknames. Now, tell me I actually find that very amusing, all the nicknames they have that they hate. It's like people used to call me, like, I think they called me Ingy or something like that. I hated that name. I mean, these names that people hate. Do you have a nickname?
I do. It's Woody.
Woody.
And that comes from I was on a target one time running amok, being a commanding presence, and they said I look like Woody from Toy Story.
Oh, glad it was something else.
But no, not something else. It's Woody from Toy Story. Most people think it's something else, but...
I mean, it's interesting how names can mean one or a couple different things at once. You know? But the Widow Strike, this new one, and this, I should tell everybody, it's from Dutton, and it's out in all the bookstores now, online and everything. It's funny it's saying bookstores anymore. There's like no bookstores left. Everything's online now, it seems like.
Yeah, well, hopefully Barnes & Noble's coming back because they got their new CEO, so.
Oh, I didn't know that. When did that happen?
Last week, the old CEO is now the new CEO, and he's apparently going to cut the nook free and focus on the brick-and-mortar stores, so we'll see how that goes.
Oh, really? That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, they won't have an e-book reader anymore?
Well, they will. They're just, the prediction is he's not saying anything officially. The prediction is that he's not going to focus so much effort on it as they have in the past.
Right.
Basically concede defeat.
Now, you're in Charleston, South Carolina. Is that Pat, what's his name?
It is, Pat Conroy.
Oh, God, I couldn't think of his last name. Isn't that, our brains just did. But anyway, you're right near him. Didn't he go to the Citadel, too?
He did go to the Citadel. Well, I mean, I have a lot of history here. My dad went to the Citadel. I have a twin brother who went to the Citadel, so...
What are you like? If I met you on the street, what are you like as a person?
You mean, what do I look like physically?
No, we can see your picture, but I mean, what are you like? I mean, you seem very personable.
Yeah, I actually have a pretty good sense of humor and pretty personable, sure. I enjoy these tours that I'm going to do on because, you know, you meet the fans and they get to ask you questions and it's good interaction.
Now, do you go all over the country on your book tour?
I do. The publisher sets it up. This is a Southwest tour, I guess you'd say. I'm going to start out here and end up, I guess the furthest west will be Phoenix, and then come back.
That's the sad part sometimes when you look for your author to see if they're in your area. No, they're all over the country. They're everywhere but you where you are. and you have to try to find them, you know. And now with these new things where they can sign books somehow, I don't know how all that works, but I mean, the days of seeing an author in person seem to be dwindling. I mean, it's like you used to be able to go anywhere and see an author. Now it's like, well, they're such selected cities that they go to anymore. And usually,
yeah, I think it's more of a function of, I'm new to this, so don't take my word as gospel. I'm still learning my way. But I think it's a function of just what we were talking about, the decline of the independent brick-and-mortar bookstore. So if you don't have a bookstore, you're not going to have a place for the guy to go to.
Now, your first book, how did that sell?
They did real well. All of them have hit the New York Times bestseller list.
Right. I mean, this is your fourth one, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking for the title of the first one. I can't find it in the book, but I know it's in there. But now, the Widow Strike, you've already said it has to do with Elena. But tell everybody who hasn't read it a little bit about more of the plot of the book.
I was watching the news. I keep up on current events. And about a year ago, there was a story on BBC about... the American Biosafety Advisory Board, which I didn't know we had, but apparently we do, they were having a fit over a laboratory in the EU, the European Union, had genetically modified H5N1 avian flu, and we're studying it, and we're going to publish their results. And the Biosafety Board said, while you're doing something for a good reason to prevent a pandemic, you publish those results, you're giving a recipe for a bioweapon that will wipe out the Earth. And I saw that and said, well, that's a story right there. And so it starts from that.
Amazing. You know, it is how easy it is for these people to get, these bad people to get these things that it can really do some destruction.
Yeah, it's really actually what surprises me is it hasn't happened before.
Right, and which is amazing. I mean, you just think about that. Now, what a strike. How long did this take you to write? I mean, do all your books take about the same time besides the research? I mean...
Top to bottom, that took about 6 months, including the research.
Right. Now, how do you start it? I mean, what's the beginning? I mean, you obviously do your research, but you come home, and then what goes on?
Generally, what I'll do is I'll have a Like I'm working on, I just finished book five and I'm starting book six right now, and I'll have an idea of the threat, and I'll have a starting point and a finishing point, but nothing else in between. I have people ask if I outline, and I say no, I design what I call a framework. It's definitely not an outline, and it'll have broad brush strokes in it, and then as I start writing, then I get down to the nitty-gritty and flush it out.
Now, has Jennifer and Pike Logan, have they been romantically involved in the past?
No, when they first met, they hated each other, and they've kind of grown to, you know, obviously like each other, and they're still trying to deal with what they're.
I feel like there's something there. There's something brewing, sort of like Sam and Diane on Cheers.
Yeah.
So I'm not.
They're just not sure where it's going. Pike, if you haven't read the series, I don't want to give anything away, but he's suffered a pretty horrific loss in the very first book, and so he's kind of damaged goods.
Right. Now, this is the first one of the series that I've read, you know, But it's interesting, even the name Pike Logan, it's just such a strong name.
Well, see, Pike is his call sign, and he gets that call sign for making a ridiculous comment in training in the first book. So.
Right, and that's how it all started. Now, do you envision this being a 20-book series? I mean, do you think about how long it's going to be? I mean, it's not like, I mean, nowadays it's everything's trilogies and, you know.
No, I don't. I mean, I'll write as long as I can write. I haven't put a set number to it. And it's funny you mentioned trilogy. I didn't know there would be a book one, much less a book three. But the first three books kind of were a trilogy. There's an opening in the first book, which I left open precisely because I thought it was a good way to end the book, and everybody assumed I was teasing the reader. So by the third book, I got so many emails, I brought this bad guy back, and it kind of gives closure. And then the fourth book, which we're on now, The Widow Strike, is kind of the... Pike's kind of fixed himself up, and now he's moving forward.
So, did you know when you wrote book one that this is what you really wanted to do? That you would do this as long as they let you, as long as you could publish?
Yes, it was one of the reasons I retired from the military. It was a hard decision to retire.
What made it so hard? You just loved it so much?
Well, one, I loved it. Two, we are at war. Three, I have a skill set that few people have, and I can contribute. And it was kind of just a hard decision to say. I had a lot of people asking me to stay, and I, you know, telling them, no, I'm not going to. And then when the book sold, I said, okay, I'll give this a try.
Now, where were you born?
I was born in Okinawa, Japan.
Oh, my God. In Japan. Wow. All the way over there.
Mm-hmm. Actually, as a side note, my daughter... I was serving in 1st Special Forces Group over there, and there's a 1 in 4 chance she was born in the same room as me.
Really?
There's only 4 birthing rooms, and they haven't changed since I was born. So.
Now, what are your parents' backgrounds? Are they were Japanese?
No. My dad was in Vietnam. They're both from Charleston, South Carolina.
Oh, okay. But you were born in Japan, so it's just where he was stationed at the time.
Right. Yeah.
So you were traveling even before you came out of the womb. It's all over the place. It seems like traveling is in your life plan there.
Yeah.
You seem to like it a lot. Now you're in Charleston now.
Uh-huh.
What do you do when you're not writing? I mean, what kind of things? Obviously, anything to do with military.
I'll say that the writing has just now become kind of a full-time thing. Before I did, my primary method of income was security consulting. I did a lot of contract work as a independent contractor for various agencies on asymmetric threats here and abroad. And then the writing got more and more, and now the writing has pretty much consumed me. I spend most of my time writing.
So is it difficult to come up with plots? To think, I mean, do they come to you pretty quickly as far as what you can write about?
It's, you know, I'm still learning my way. I just finished book five, and book five was kind of tough. I had I had the idea of what I wanted to do, but it was difficult to square the circle, so to speak. The Widow Strike was, I don't know why, it just was easy. When I had that research done, I sailed through that and just went ripping to it.
So what you need to do is figure out why it was so easy for a Widow Strike and just duplicate it every time, you know?
I know. I've been racking my brain. Trust me. I'm like, how did I do that? I wish I had taken notes. I remember when I wrote All Necessary Force after writing One Rough Man, and I started to write, and I was thinking, how did I do this? I couldn't remember how I'd done it.
And that's the thing with memory. You have to be careful with memory. I mean, I don't know what your age is, but you look like you're in your 30s. No. 22 years, I don't think you're in your 30s. People are thinking, 30s? How can he say 30s? You know, he's got to be older than 30, but he just looks so young in your books. But yeah, you know, that's. I think readers forget sometimes how much research is involved in a book. I mean, readers will pick up a book, and if they read fast, sometimes they can have it read one night. And then what do? You know, you have to wait a year for the next book. It's torture for a reader sometimes.
Right. I've just started on a book every six-month cycle, so that's why I'm saying the writing has gotten consumed my life a lot more.
But you're in a six-month cycle, but we only see a new book by you every year, then.
No, you see one six-month cycle. Enemy of Mine, my third book, was out last January. The Widow Strike is out today.
Oh, really?
Lawyer's Protocol will be out next January.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that. I thought it was one a year. Wow, two a year? So you're on a two-a-year book schedule.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. The writing has pretty much consumed me now.
Wow.
So the other thing that's hard about it when you write a book is, in the real world, things can happen that are improbable, and they just because it's a real world, that's just how it works. In a novel, you can't have that, because someone will always say, that doesn't make any sense, why'd he do that? But people always do crazy things. You know, if you were doing the Boston bombing and some of the ridiculous mistakes they made there that ended up getting them caught, you can't do that in a novel, because then people say, nobody be that stupid.
Right.
If you wrote a novel that said, terrorists learned to fly but did not learn to land, they would say, we'd find out about that, that's a weak plot.
Well, yeah, I think about that when I'm reading sometimes. Sometimes the character will ask a question, and I'll think, well, why would that character ask that question? Don't they know that already? You know, you think that's a tribute to the writer, that they know what their character should know by then. Or, you know, there's so
much. Sometimes you have to remind the reader that something happens in the front part of the book, and it's just kind of a nibble, and you've got to nibble it again later, otherwise they'll miss it completely. I've had people miss in One Rough Man, the horrific event I was telling you about Pike. It's a certain guy that does that, and it's clearly who it is. And at the end of the book, I'll get an email. Who's the one that killed Pike's family? We never found out. I'm like, really?
Yeah, they all want resolution, but they don't always see the resolution. You can put it right in front of them, and they still don't see it sometimes. And these readers are very, very particular, and they know when you make a mistake, they're going to be all over you.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely true. I've made a couple.
I remember Dean Koontz saying that he made a mistake on a gun one time, and he got all these letters and messages about it. And so he said, I determined then I was going to, you know, find out about guns and know everything there was about guns so I wouldn't make that mistake again. I mean, sometimes it's good to make a mistake because then you can correct it.
Yeah, I actually had one of the big mistakes I made in my first mistake was... And One Rough Man, Pike and Jennifer in Guatemala, and they carjack a Chevy Cutlass and then drive it away. Well, it turns out Oldsmobile makes a Cutlass, and boy, did I hear about that.
Oh, man.
No such thing as a Chevy Cutlass. It's Oldsmobile.
And
I got 100 emails on that.
Amazing. I mean, and it's so easy to make that mistake. I mean,
it's funny. Is the reason I made that mistake is I owned a Cutlass in college, so I didn't bother to research it. In my head, it was just a Chevy. We were talking about memory. In my memory, it was a Chevy Cutlass. I never bothered to look it up because I had one.
Right.
But it turns out I should have looked it up. I was
right.
Wrong.
Well, that just makes you more determined to do the research and get it right, so they don't say that to you again. Now, somebody who's come along and would just read The Widow Strike, do you think they should read the first three first? I mean, does that help?
It would help, but it's certainly not necessary. You know, they're all standalone. See, the only thing about The Widow Strike, if you read The Widow Strike or any of the books first, without starting with One Rough Man, is there are some spoilers in The Widow Strike that reference the Enemy of Mine. For instance, when Blood gets his call sign in The Widow Strike, that's based on an action that happened in Enemy of Mine. I don't flesh it out, but you do get a few spoilers, so you kind of know what's happening.
Right, but you can read them independently of each other. It's always a thing. I mean, whenever you... there's some series I want to read, and I look, and there's like 15 books before the one that's out now, and I think, oh my God, I got to read 15 books? And then, you know, it's a little daunting when you have a lot of reading. I mean, you like to start...
I work very hard to make sure they are standalone. There's nothing in there that you don't scratch your head and go, what? I don't get this. The most you get is I kind of reward the reader that has read the other books, because they'll go, aha, I know exactly what he's talking about. But if you haven't read the book, it doesn't affect the plot, so you can just keep going.
Right, and you don't have to have been in the military to really get into these books either. I mean, it's not like you have to know everything about the military to...
No, actually, it's probably my biggest compliment I get, is I don't spend a lot of time on the military side of the house. If there's a reason for me to use a tactical technique or procedure or a specific piece of kit, then I'll describe that piece of kit, a weapon or something. Otherwise, I don't see the reason to beat the reader over the head with what the guy's wearing on his feet and what kind of sunglasses he has and what type of pistol's in his hand. If I can say pistol, the reader gets it.
Right, and that's the thing. You don't want to be too descriptive and bore the reader, too. You have to know exactly.
Yeah, I need to say it's a Glock 19 with a 15-round magazine. You know, who cares? It's a pistol. I got it.
That's what I like about your book. It keeps going on. I mean, there's always something happening. It's never there's never a dull moment with Pike. He's always got some dilemma. The one dilemma he has in the beginning of the book about the guy, the person in the rug, I'll say. I don't want to say too much about it, but, you know, there's so much, and he gets to these points where he's got to make a quick decision, and sometimes either way he goes, something bad's going to happen.
Right. Yeah, and actually I've seen that in real life. That's just kind of a...
Did you experience that when you were in the military?
Yeah, I've seen that very thing come to pass, where you're kind of put in a moral quandary of the... Right now, right thing to do is this, but the long-term effect is going to be bad.
Right.
And so you're kind of like, which way do I go on this?
So how did you resolve it the first time you came across it, when you were in the military, the first time you had that kind of situation? What did you do?
Well, every time I've seen that situation, we have done what I would consider the right thing and save the individual and let the mission go to pieces. I mean, you can't let the individual die, so...
Right, and it's a moral thing, too. I mean, can you stand there and watch somebody die when you know there's something you can do about it? I mean, anybody would say, well, no, you save the person first, but it does seem to be the right decision. I mean, who knows?
But there is a moral conscience there. In so doing, you're going to compromise that terrorist cell, and that terrorist is now going to kill more people. So you save the one guy. You could have prevented the deaths of untold numbers of others. You don't know how many because you don't know how many he's going to kill. So it's kind of a... Yeah, you know, it is a quandary.
Now, where are you headed on your tour now?
I leave to tomorrow morning. I'm going to Atlanta, and from there, I'd have to look at my schedule. I think Albuquerque after that.
Right. Now, are there certain stores you enjoy going to? Are there certain people that you see time on your tour every book you have?
I enjoy all of them. I really do. Everybody's really welcoming, and they're all good experiences. My publisher spends a lot of time analyzing, so I do go to some of the same stores repeatedly, but not every single time, because they kind of want to spread the wealth around. You know, right now I've got people in California who are screaming, you've never been out here before, why aren't you coming out here? So my publisher looks at it and says, like for The Enemy of Mine in January, it was in the Northeast, and I went to Chicago and Cincinnati and those kind of areas, and this time it's out west a little bit.
Right. How do you come up with titles for your books? Do you have trouble with the titles? A lot of authors just say they have awful times thinking up a title.
Oh, I do. That's my worst thing are titles. I hate titles. And my publisher gnashes my teeth. That's the first thing they want. I don't care about the book. Give me the title. Because they've got to start doing catalogs and things like that. And I don't ever have a title until I'm done with a book. So it is a hard thing to do.
Right.
The Polaris Protocol, which I just finished, that title came out fairly easily, but that was probably the only one. The Widow Strike took forever. In fact, Elena, the antagonist, the Chechen Black Widow, originally she was just going to be a bit player, just somehow to get the Kutz Force involved with the task force, and it was going to be kind of a force-on-force thing, state-on-state. And the more research I did on Chechnya and the phenomena of the female suicide terrorists, Elena grew to be a much more complex character, where she wasn't completely evil or completely nice. She was human, and it actually altered the trajectory of the title.
Now, wait a minute. Are you saying Elena, this isn't the first time she's appeared in the Widow Strike?
No, it is the first time.
It is the first time, but she's going to appear again.
No.
Oh, okay.
I was just saying, when I first conceived of using her, she was just going to be a bit player, not really. Other than being a facilitator for an attack, she wasn't going to factor in heavily in the book. But the more research I did on the real-world phenomena, Black Widows are real. It's a Chechen phenomena from that conflict. And the more research I did in the Chechnya and the Black Widow phenomena, the more intriguing she became to me in my head. And so I started developing her as a character until she kind of overcame the Kutz Force itself, and that's reflected in the title.
Now, do you go to the International Thriller Writers Convention?
I do. This year is the first year I haven't been since it's because of the book launch.
Tell me what it's like. I've never been to one of them. I want to go at some point, but tell me what that's like.
It's pretty much a collegial. That's the only one I've been to, so I can't say whether it's like Bookeron or not, or whether it's all the other writers.
You mean BastardCon? You mean? Is that what you mean?
Oh yeah. What, a rock concert?
Yeah, Budokan. I've got something different. But.
I haven't been to any other ones, so I can only say what ITW is like. And it's pretty collegial. There's a lot of blending of writers and fans together in different panels and things like that.
Right. So it's panel thing, discussion panel, like it is with Africa and all those other ones. So it's kind of, but then you get to meet so many different people. It must be fun in some ways.
Last year, I was actually kind of, I flew back from Hong Kong straight into Thriller Fest, and I was jet lagged for 3 days, so probably wasn't the best decision.
Right. Well, you don't always know until you get into the situation that sometimes that it's going to, you know, it's not always going to work out, or it's not always going to be.
Yeah.
I mean, you do a lot of writing, so you're constantly thinking.
So this year, because the launch of the book was today, we decided not to do it. It was just too much to cram into the bag.
Oh, the actual launch date, the book came out today. I didn't realize
that. Yeah, today's the launch date.
I'm just looking at some, and, you know, you have a blur from Vince Flynn, who unfortunately has passed away. Did you know Vince Flynn?
Out of the blue, he had said in his newsletter that he was reading All Necessary Force, my second book, and then he gave a review for it, and so then we contacted him. I was flattered and sent him an email and said that, you know, flattered you looked at my book and read it. I'm glad you enjoyed it. And then he had his people reach out to me, and they did an interview with me and that kind of thing.
Now, what kind of, you must have some kind of hobbies besides writing. I mean, if it's something you enjoy, obviously military stuff, but I mean, you must be a history buff too.
I am. I do a lot of reading. I obviously read a lot about world events. I try to keep up on current events.
If we walked into your house now and looked at your bedside table, what books would be on it?
They're not going to be very sexy right now because I'm doing research for the next book. So I've got, going to my bedside table, I've got Blowing Up Russia, The Secret Plot to Bring Back KGB Terror, the New Elites, or the New, and that's about the FSB rise in Russia. So it's a lot of Russian history.
So do you read mostly nonfiction?
No, I mean, I do now just because of my job. I have to get the research done. But no, I read a lot of fiction. Love fiction.
Tell me some writers, people out there saying, ask him who he reads. Find out who he reads. You know, so who?
Well,
do you read?
Actually, believe it or not, I don't read my own genre.
You don't? And why is that?
Well, now it's just because I kind of want to keep myself clean. But it's more a function of, I just always like murder mysteries, to be honest with you. So
really?
Robert Crace and John Sanford and all those, Mike Connelly, that's who I read.
Well, we have a lot in common because that's what I love, too.
Yeah, those are my favorite books.
Interesting. I never expected you to say that. what in your mind, when you pick up a book, what do you look for? I mean, what are the most important things for you?
Character is one of the most important things for me. But obviously the plot, it's got to keep moving along. I don't like a lot of, you don't have to explain a lot of things to me. I mean, I can figure it out. If you just give me enough to get the plot going, I can go. And I think John Sanford and Robert Crace do a good job at that.
I'm reading the new, it isn't even out yet, but the new Elizabeth George book. It's 700 and some pages. It's a long book. And, you know, with a mystery, you have to keep the action going. You can't have too much description. You've got to keep it.
Right.
You've got to keep it interesting all the way through. Now, her last book was just fascinating. I mean, this one's a little bit slow because it's got a lot of stuff in Italy, and there's Italian in there that I don't understand. So, and you know, that's the point with a book. It's got to be interesting. You've got to keep how do you keep your books interesting?
I think I keep them interesting by specifically putting the characters in dilemmas. That's something that the reader can relate to. Oh, if I was in that position, I could see why they feel that way. And now I'm actively attached to the character to see how they get out of that dilemma. Be it the small dilemma we were just talking about with the long-tail boats, or the larger dilemma of, and the Widow Strike writ large, the theme that comes out, not intentionally, I don't ever have a, you know, intentional theme of my book, it just kind of comes out, is if you had a pandemic, I mean, how evil would we become to prevent the destruction of our country? When would we lose the individual right for the collective good? Because, you know, when they get rid of avian flu in the bird communities in Southeast Asia, you know how they get rid of it?
What's that?
They kill all the birds.
Oh,
if one bird comes up with avian flu in a flock of a million, they'll kill all million of them.
Wow.
And, you know, would we do the same thing? If somebody is suspected of being infected with avian flu, with this genetically mutated avian flu, it's a big risk to sit there and say, well, let's see if they get sick, because Like, I did a lot of research on the flu, obviously. The 1918 flu, which killed about a fifth of the world's population before we had airplanes and cars and everything else, it killed more Americans. The Spanish flu in 1918 killed more Americans than all wars we fought combined. And that had a mortality rate of about 3%. Mm-hmm. Right now, the avian flu, the H5N1, which is why everybody's so petrified of it, has a mortality rate of 60%.
Is that right?
So in 1918, two people out of 100 died, and we lost a fifth of the world's population without airplanes or transmission capabilities that we have nowadays. Now you get the avian flu and it's out, six people out of 10 are going to die.
Right.
So it's a pretty scary thing. And would you, if that guy's got it, would you want to spend all your time proving beyond a shadow of a doubt he has it, or just get rid of him?
Right.
On the off chance he does. And that's kind of a theme that comes out. I mean, how far would we go?
How far would a person go to yeah, it's not an easy, you know, it's not a black and white issue either. I mean, you really
Far a person would go, it's how far would your government go? The government has a collective responsibility to protect the nation, not every individual. So if that individual's got it.
And what if it's somebody you know? What if it's somebody you know and love?
Then exactly.
Everything
yeah.
changes. I mean, there's so many gray areas with things. I mean, everybody thinks, well, it's easy. It's just this or that. It's got to be one or the other. You just have to, but it isn't. Nothing. Now, these characters in your books, now you say they're based on real people you know?
Well, they're kind of a compilation of people I've served with. In fact, the Widow's Strike, if you've got the advanced reader copy, you don't have the acknowledgments. I had a friend of mine that was KIA in Afghanistan when I was writing that book, and it's dedicated to him. People like him are who formed my vision of what Pike would be.
Right. So, do these people know that they could be in your books? I mean, do they write to you and say, "Who am I? Which one am I?" Or do they know when they read it?
We do. I don't ever. I make it a firm thing not to say, you know, anybody's one way or the other. But I've had friends. They all know. I mean, I have readers. I don't want to give anything classified away in the book.
Oh, yeah.
I have people read it before it goes to my editor, and they're all the same. They're operators like me.
Yeah, don't tell me anything now that it's classified. They have to kill me. I'm going to get the flu and die.
There's not anything classified in the books. I always pull it out because they'll tell me to take it out. But I have a friend of mine that says, he says, "What part of me? I must be the pinky toe. Am I the pinky toe of Pike?"
It's interesting because people are very aware of that. People that you know, when you're a writer, people.
Yeah.
I think authors get that a lot. You know, which character am I? Who am I most like? You know.
Most people ask, "Are you Pike Logan?" And I tell them, "No, I'm definitely not Pike Logan. Pike Logan is. I served with Pike Logan, but he's kind of like Tiger Woods, and I'm like 200 on the money list of the PGA Tour.
Tiger Woods without all the sex, all
yeah,
the women.
Exactly. So I mean, he's got the. So Pike Logan's at the top of his game. I'm in the PGA, but you've never heard of me.
Right? Are you into sports at all? Are you a sports person?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I'm not a fanatic. My brother's a fanatic, but I'm not. I mean, I'll watch college ball. I don't really care about the NBA is about the only thing I really have no time for whatsoever.
Now, can you actually, when you're writing in your house, can you actually watch TV, do other things, listen to music, or do you have?
No, I found that I can write anywhere. That's one thing I did find. It's probably because of military background, but I mean, I wrote One Rough Man, you name it, all over the place. In fact, every book has some flavor of Charleston in it. And it's because I have written some portion of a book in a bar somewhere while I was waiting on my kids or something, and that ended up making a scene of the book. I found that if I do have the TV on, though, here at the house, I end up piddling around. I don't end up writing.
So you know your own strengths and weaknesses. You know what makes you weak.
I have to get out of here and go somewhere else. I'll either go to the library or somewhere, just somewhere that I can focus on.
I know that when I read books and then I turn the TV on, sometimes I focus more on the TV than I do on the book, and I think, oh, how am I going to get this done if I watch TV? Because you turn the TV on before you know you're hooked on something, whatever it might be. There's just something that grabs you. Do you watch a lot of CNN? Do you watch a lot of these news programs to get to see what's going on in the world?
I actually use the internet more than I do watch TV. I find that most of the news programs are sensationalist. I mean, let's take last week, for instance. I mean, you couldn't turn TV on without seeing Zimmerman, and I could absolutely care less about that entire episode.
Yeah.
24/7, it was all Zimmerman. So I have to go online and go to BBC's websites, Al Jazeera, things like that, to get, there is something else happening in the world.
Just like when the OJ thing happened, that's all you heard about, OJ, for months and months and months. You just get so sick of it. I mean, there's only so much. My dad could watch it nonstop, but it's, you know, you just... there's it comes to a point where, you know, enough is enough. I mean,
yeah.
The same with Lindsay Lohan. I mean, we're all sick of hearing about Lindsay Lohan.
Right.
You know, it's just at a certain point, you just enough, just enough. So, I mean, it is. It's very difficult. So you do sit in a room and write without any distractions. Do you have children?
I do. I have two daughters.
Two daughters. Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful. So you're doing a good thing. I mean, you're being productive and getting these books out, which is great. Every 6 months, I can't believe you're writing one. Every 6 months, you're becoming a Nora Roberts.
Well, I know, and we just started doing it, and it's not an easy task to do. Yeah, I mean, you really have to buckle down and plan things out. I mean, I remember thinking, you know, I wrote, because you have your entire life to write your first book.
I wanted to ask you if there's any famous people that read your books. Are there any famous names you can throw out that you know read you?
No, not that I'm officially aware of. I know Newt Gingrich has read them. Obviously, Vince Flynn has read them, but I don't. Nobody's contacted.
What did Newt Gingrich? You haven't heard what he thought of him?
Actually, he said he liked it.
Well, that's quite a compliment. There you go. And Vince Flynn did another compliment. I still remember meeting him, and what a nice man. Just a really nice human being. It's still hard to believe that he's no longer with us.
I know, because last I heard, he was getting better, and then it just out of the blue. It was out of the blue for me. I'm sure it wasn't for everybody else, but for
right.
me it was.
So you're working on book six now. Now, you stay like two books ahead usually, or try to?
Well, I literally just hit the end on book five probably 2 weeks ago.
How do you know it's the end? I mean, how do you know when there's no more you can do with a book? I've always wondered.
Actually, funny you should say that. I had to chop, my editor made me chop a little bit of the end of this one because I had something I had to tie up at the end of the book. The primary catalyst that's going on with the book is solved, but there's this outlier that's dangling out there, so I went ahead and solved that one too. And I thought to myself when I read it, I said, this is kind of like being on a roller coaster and going over the big hill, and then you think it's done, and you're starting to go uphill again. Have I tricked the reader? Are they going to get mad about this?
Well,
and I had a few people read it, and they said that, no, I think it works out well.
When you were writing The Widow's Strike, I mean, as you're writing the book, do you know everything that's going to happen before you start writing?
No, not at all. I have broad, I know I'm going to Hong Kong, for instance, and that's about it. And then I basically sketch out a section of the book. I have a journal I carry on with me everywhere I go, and I'll sketch out, here's what I think should happen here, and here's how this is going to work. But I don't. And the hard part is that sometimes you have to solve a problem, like in The Widow Strike, they're trying to track this guy down. Well, how do you have to, have an anchor to track a human being? The manhunting is not it's not like the movies. It's kind of hard to do. And so then I had to go back and rewrite that this guy goes in and buys cell phones so that they can go in and get the IMIs of the cell phone so they can start tracking the phone. But I have to go back to do that. And sometimes those little threads get to be... It's much easier to go back and add something than it is to go back and cut something.
Right.
Because you cut one sentence in page 12, and the next thing you know, that thing has had an effect all the way through like ripples in a pond.
Right. I was reading a book the other day, and the editors, sometimes I read a book and I'm like, how did that get past the editor? It's just a stupid mistake. And I wonder, you know, how much the editors really do. I mean, obviously, does your editor know all, to have a military background? Does he know all the military stuff?
No, not at all. No, he's perfect at, he's really good at pacing and flow. I mean, he doesn't dictate to me. He doesn't say, you know, I want you to have this girl say that.
So they don't have a military editor for you and somebody who,
no.
In case you've made a mistake somewhere or with a gun or whatever, something that happened in the military?
Well, actually, I mean, that's a copy editor. So the main editor, who's really
right,
commander-in-chief of the whole project, is in charge of the title and everything else. He's the one that tells me that you should actually have two of them now because I'm on a two-book-a-year cycle. They'll tell me, I think you need to add to this, and that this would be strengthened if you did that. Just a general idea, and it's up to me to come up how to do it.
Right. Are they always right, or sometimes do you argue with them and say, no, I'm...
Oh, no, we go back and forth quite a bit. For The Widow Strike, I think there was one thing they wanted me to do. They wanted to change, I can't remember what it was now, but I was dead set against it. I said, I just can't do that. And if I articulate, here's the reason why. This is going, what was going to happen? It was going to turn Jennifer into an absolute, I mean, just a real bad word, word. And so I said, I just can't do that. It's going to alter her character too much. And they agreed with me. But, you know, about 80% of the time, he is right.
Right.
In this instance I was talking about for the book I just finished, I sense in my own head that the ending was kind of a double hill for the roller coaster, and he came back and said, you need to chop that last chapter down, just put it in a couple sentences off the page that it got wrapped up, but we don't need to read about it. And so that's basically what I did. But we have copy editors that come through and read, and they're the ones that are supposed to find the Oldsmobile Cutlass problem.
Right, exactly. Those silly little things that are very important, but they're not.
And they find a ton of them. But it's 9 times out of 10, if they're doing military stuff, they'll try to correct something militarily. And I mean, you're wasting your time if you think I made a military mistake.
Well, I know we have to let you go. You have another interview. So I wondered, The next book will be out in about 6 months?
Yeah, in January.
It's been a lot of fun. I really enjoyed talking to you, Brad. And the book, again, is called The Widow Strike. It's out from Dutton and all your bookstores and online all over the place. Thank you very much.
My website at bradtaylorbooks.com if you want to read that.
There you go, bradtaylorbooks.com. Check it out. And you're a nice guy, Brad. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you.
And this has been David's Book Talk. We'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.